I was looking up what Adam Canfield was, what his other alias was. So he goes from being Peter Joshua, random guy, to Alexander Dial, I'm the dead guy's brother.
Right.
To Adam Canfield, I'm actually just a professional thief, but I'm still very charming.
Yes.
Please help. Please help.
Yeah.
To, I'm actually sorry, I'm the government.
Right. Okay. Okay. So it's a journey of like...
sorry, I'm the government.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which everyone from the government is legally obliged to say to you when they introduce
themselves.
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
I work for the government.
I am the government.
I'm sorry. Government. Sorry to disappoint. I work for the government.
Yeah.
So why do we watch this? The podcast where three friends watch a troubled movie, talk about what they liked, what they didn't like, and how they would fix it, all while enjoying a themed cocktail. C'est moi, your host for this week, Brendan the Seeker Drischler.
I am Chris, Devil of Deception Ravel.
And I am Lee, Monsieur Dial.
Delahanty. I really do. It does have, like, the air of someone who doesn't speak the language, like, repeating, like, themselves louder with more emphasis. Like, no. Where is the restaurant?
Yeah. Steak dinner.
And as I'm sure you can tell by our terrific accent work and the subjects in which we were discussing, the movie we did for this episode is 2002's The Truth About Charlie, directed by Jonathan Demme. It is, as you may or may not know, a remake of the 1963 movie Charade, but also an homage to Truffaut's Shoot the Piano Player.
And French New Wave more broadly.
Yeah, and a lot of just French New Wave stuff in general. This is a movie starring Mark Wahlberg, Tandiwe Newton, Tim Robbins, Joon-hoon Park, Ted Levine. That was the name that we could not figure out.
Yes,
we kept struggling to remember his name and could not, but didn't look it up.
We got Ted, at least.
We did. And Lisa Gay Hamilton, and I think that's, like, most of it. What?
She's Lola.
Right, she's Lola, yes. Yes, and Christine Boisson as Commandant Dominique, who I feel like is kind of, like, the only other... woman,
person.
Like, really. Oh, Tim Robbins, did I say Robbins?
Yeah, you said
I'm sure.
Tim Robbins.
Okay, yeah, he's third build. Good for him. Anyway, so before we can discover what the truth about Charlie indeed is, first, of course, we had to be suitably juiced up by drinking a themed cocktail for this movie. And the cocktail that we made is called Decency, Dignity, and Gumption. And it is 2 ounces of gin, half an ounce of chartreuse, 1 ounce of lemon juice, half an ounce of simple, fresh basil leaves, and orange bitters. So in a cocktail shaker, you gently muddle 3 basil leaves with simple syrup. Add gin, chartreuse, lemon juice, and a dash of orange bitters to the shaker. Add ice and shake until chilled. Strain it into a coupe glass and garnish with a lemon twist and basil leaf floating on top. What did you think of the drink, Ms. Emmy?
I think it could have been a little tartar, but I think in general, I like the citric flavor. I liked the basil. It was very pretty. The yellow color was nice.
I enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to enjoy it, I have to say. I do agree, Lee, you had mentioned...
Oh, yeah, sweet. I found it a little too sweet for me.
Yeah.
I have a very low bar for sweetness.
But I
do think you were right. It could have, I think, stood to have been less sweet in retrospect. So I don't know if it was just the combination of both, like, the lemon juice and the simple that was in there probably that tipped it over, perhaps. Is chartreuse... Actually, I don't know what chartreuse really...
Chartreuse isn't very sweet. It's usually pretty herbal.
Yeah, I actually don't really know. I
is
don't
it
think
listening?
I...
Whoa.
yeah, it is.
No, but
I
don't know. It might have been the simple, but it was just a little too much simple.
Yeah, probably.
Put less simple in.
Probably was. I could have definitely gone for less simple.
But I thought it was yummy overall.
But yeah, no, that being said, I still enjoyed it. And as someone who's not really a fan of, like, herbal liqueurs, it ended up working pretty well for me. Again, probably because it was more sweet than, like, herbal. I'm sure that's what tipped it over for me.
We drank a cocktail, which, you know, alcohol is a depressant. And it was great because then we got to watch this movie that is kind of hard to follow, but now with our senses dulled.
That makes it all the better.
Yeah.
Is that what you want when you're watching a
No,
I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah, unequivocally, no. This is unequivocally not a movie that has helped by having your senses dulled in any way, shape, or form. If you thought that Charade was perhaps a bit too much to follow, you are going to have a hard time with The Truth About Charlie, I must admit.
You were kind of getting into this while we were watching it, but, like, It's not like Charade's plot, if you were to lay it out beat for beat, makes any sense either.
Well, no, I mean, I would say that Charade's plot makes sense, but it's very hard for you to, like, think back and be like, correct. A leads to B leads to C but leads to D.
They effectively made it so it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because you're having too good of a time to care, which right. I think is the magic of Charade. I think one of the many mistakes this movie makes is, hey, what if we took the plot seriously but made it really hard to pay attention?
Right. Well, so before we go too much into, you know, the specifics of what makes this movie tick and why it happened and all that sort of things. Normally, this is the point where we would turn to our friend Wikipedia for a synopsis of the movie that we've just watched. However, as we found out, the synopsis on Wikipedia... Is it... Go, read it, Lee. Do you have it?
Sure.
Just give it to us as it is, and we'll try and, like, fill it in as needed after the fact.
All two?
Yeah, all two, baby. Give it to me. Ooh, I got time. Hey, I got time.
It starts with a note and
ooh, what's the note?
It says this article needs an improved plot summary.
Doesn't it though?
Oh god.
Well, I'm glad someone else thought like we did.
Just as dated November 2015.
Great.
So we got
what a time to have been alive.
Some time to get this in, guys. British newlywed Regina Lambert lives in Paris with her husband Charles. We all agree that's
a this is a fact.
She returns home following a short vacation, determined to divorce Charles, only to discover their apartment has been stripped bare and that her husband has been murdered. The French police are in her apartment. Charles had liquidated their possessions for $1.8 million and the money is missing. Regina is soon reunited with a mysterious... Reunited?
Because they do meet on vacation.
Which is weird why they wouldn't...
Summer didn't say that, but...
Yes. Oh, yeah, but yeah, again, weird that it was not mentioned that she met him on vacation.
On this vacation,
but...
she met Mark Wahlberg.
Yes.
Reunited with a mysterious stranger, Joshua... Mark Wahlberg. She met on her holiday. He helps her piece together the truth about the deceased Charlie and deal with the three menacing people who are now following her.
I mean,
now,
sort
that's
of,
the rest of the movie.
Now that's it.
The three people are soldiers? Former soldiers?
They're former soldiers.
I think they were kind of like a fortune. What's it called?
Soldiers of Fortune?
Yeah. Weren't they? Because they weren't like official government... I think
they're part of an operation.
Right, they're part of some like operation, but I don't know.
Contracted by the military.
Yeah. Maybe I'm misreading. I don't want to get too much into the weeds about that. But
reason, they were in Yugoslavia.
Or it was about that time, right?
It was the three of them and her husband
Charles
and
another guy
Charles. Charles Lola. Sounds of the Lambs and
Yi Song, I think, is the
Yi Song.
Yeah, Lee Il Song. Lola Jansko, mm-hmm. Emil Zatopek, which is Ted Levine, mm-hmm. and Carson Dial, who is Tim Robbins' character.
Right, they were all there.
They're all there with Charlie.
With Charles,
right?
Yeah.
Things kind of go south.
But however, while like shit is going wrong and bullets are flying everywhere, Charlie sees Alexander Dial, Tim Robbins, like lying on the ground clutching the suitcase, and he's clearly been, I think, wounded in some capacity, but he's still alive. And Charlie sees him as like, oh, he's definitely dead, guys, he's dead. Let's take the
Carson
money and
Dial
run. Yeah,
the one that is on the ground.
Right, Carson Dial's lying on the ground. Yeah, and Charlie sees him and it says like, he's dead.
Alexander Dial.
Got a split. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
That's the fake one.
That's right. Alexander Dial's the fake Dial. God.
Carson Dial's the one that's actually involved in the.
Right. Carson is the real one. Alexander Dial is a fake alias that Mark Wahlberg uses at one point. They take the money back. Dial, meanwhile, is rescued by, like, a couple, taken to the doctor, mm-hmm. and gets better, and decides to make it, like, his life's goal to get this money back from mm-hmm. Charles that's rightfully his.
So they want the money because
right.
It was supposed to be
split amongst them, right? So they want what's theirs.
They think to some extent she knows what's up. She doesn't.
Right.
But she does, throughout the film, on and off, have possession of the money.
Well, so let me say real quick, if you've seen Charade, you know the broad strokes of this movie.
Right.
If you have not seen Charade, press pause, go find Charade. It's in the public domain on YouTube.
It's so good.
You can watch it.
The other element that comes into this movie, so she first meets Mark Wahlberg, who claims to just be a random dude at first.
Right. His name is Joshua Peters, he
says.
I'm
just a random guy.
Yeah.
I'm going to help
you. I'm just a guy from
South. I know you. I met you on vacation. And, you seem to be in need of some help because you have no more money. And
right. It's like, I just heard that your husband was killed. So,
let
can
me
I help
you?
Yeah.
She hijinks. She gets chased. Then she meets Tim Robbins, who claims to be from the Office of Departmental...
Some government agency.
Defense.
He presents as a
ODC?
Government agent.
Yeah.
I don't know what the acronym stands for anymore, but a government agent by the name of Bartholomew. And he claims that there's some shady shit going down, that there's this, like, this operation was part of it. Kind of explains some of the backstory to Tanduay Newton.
Mm-hmm. But he describes it as if he's a part of it. Like, he's not...
Right. Well, he says...
We're here to investigate.
Right. Like, we want this money back, this money that rightfully belongs to the U.S. government. And these are the four people who are involved with it, one of whom was your husband. The other three are the three weird-looking evil people who keep following you.
And it's Tim Robbins who tells her, like, you probably have the money already.
And you just don't know like, where. Yeah.
Like, it could be a check or, like a slip in a book that's for some, you know, safe deposit box.
Right.
Like, something. There's is in your possession somewhere. Like, he would have had it. So she has to figure out where the money is and deal with the fact that three other people are trying to get the money from
her. Who all believe that she has the money and knows where the money is. Yes.
And for a while, she and we, the viewers, are led to believe that Joshua Peters is with her against those three.
Right.
Yes.
Until we get a scene in which he enters their hotel room where the three of them are kind of lounging around doing their evil thing, and he's like, guys, you gotta get your shit together. Say hi to your mothers for me.
Yeah, and then so she finds out somehow initially that his name isn't Joshua, or that he wasn't really Joshua Peters.
Right.
Then she finds
out... Robbins tells her at one point.
Tim Robbins tells her that there's...
That's Dial. Alexander Dial.
Right.
Yeah. And so she finds out that it's Alexander Dial... And he's like, yeah, you got me. I'm not Joshua Peters. I'm actually Carson Dial's brother.
Alexander Dial.
I'm trying to find out what's going on with my brother.
Yeah.
You know, so I am invested in this.
Right.
But it's in a nice way where I still want to help you.
Right.
But meanwhile, he is also talking to the three soldiers, telling them, well, we got to get this money, guys. You want this money, right? So we're meant to, you know, it's meant to be like...
Right, who is he, like, playing here?
Very much with charade. It's like, whose side is he on?
Like, who?
Right, what is anyone's actual identity in this situation here?
And then there's this other weird element, unique to the movie, where you also later meet Charles's estranged mom.
Right.
Yep.
Who didn't know...
crazy.
Very old, yes.
Very old, didn't know that her son died.
Or was married.
Or was married.
Right.
But is mad that her son died.
Right, and blames Tanduay Newton.
Yes,
believes that Tanduay Newton is responsible for her son's death.
Yeah.
Who she hasn't seen since he left at age 14? Is that what I'm meant to believe?
Yeah. Yes.
Because he walked out because the dad was abusive.
He killed the dad, is the implication.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you have, like, all these smaller scenes of this old woman, like, kind of, like, glaring at them as they're walking around to the, like, and then, you know, as the story is progressing, the three villains are kind of getting picked off one by one. Like, Ted Levine is on a train, and he sees what you think is Mark Wahlberg. This causes him to, I guess, have some sort of heart attack and die, because he's clearly not a healthy man. And then later on, while everyone's dancing the tango at a nightclub together, all the characters are dancing with each other.
Nightclub.
I think it's indoor. I'm pretty sure it's indoor. I think it's just dark.
Oh,
I think it's just very dark indoors.
I don't know.
And maybe it is. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But so after this scene has happened, Mark Wahlberg and Tanduay Newton are going to leave, and all of a sudden you hear, like, you see, like, the point of view of someone in a car being like, allez! And you hear, like, the car start to rev, and Tanduay Newton and Mark Wahlberg are in the middle of the street, and all of a sudden the car starts, like, driving toward them, and Mark Wahlberg is, like, trying to pull her away, and then Lola, one of the three, like, villain women, shoves Tanduay Newton out of the way and, like, jumps in front of the car. Lola then flies off the hood through the window of a restaurant and is laid to rest on a pile of lettuce.
And as if she's being, like, served to the garnish.
Are we meant to think that that's... how does that happen again?
I'm not sure.
What do you... what specifically do you mean?
Because then there's also... Remember the hubcap rolls by and we're like, this is a cartoon.
Well, that's what I'm saying is, like, we find out that the first guy dies not because of it. Because if I was a smart person making this movie, I would be like, oh, we should make it look like Mark Wahlberg is doing all these killings.
Right, of course, but in actuality, yes.
Yeah, but wait, because you... It's a little sussy that we see Mark Wahlberg and we see Ted die.
Right.
But what happens is he actually saw Tim Robbins. We didn't
Sees Mark Wahlberg. Tim Robbins is like in the background.
And he has a heart attack because he's got some sort of... We see evidence that he has a weird heart condition.
Yes.
Because he's wearing an EKG monitor.
Yeah, he's got like the little suction cup type things on
him. And he doesn't seem
him.
Like a healthy man anyway.
No.
Acupuncture needles in his face.
And he sees a guy that he thinks is dead, Carson Dial, and he has a...
And he freaks out, has a heart attack.
He just dies naturally. But the car accident, is that just random chaos?
Well, that's the mother trying to kill Tanduay Newton because she thinks that she killed her son. No, I agree with you. It's nuts. It's nuts. It's ridiculous.
Okay, so anyway, that one happens. And then you think that... Il-sung dies because
he's bloodied up,
Well,
also, just before you get to that point,
yeah,
this is when we find out then they've been trying to figure out, like, again, what is the deal with this money? Where is this money? Where could this money possibly be? You see a scene of Tandy Wade Newton going through her shit, and she's reading a letter that her husband sent her, and all of a sudden, like, oh, a light bulb goes off in her head. She calls up the police commandant, and you don't hear what they're saying, but the police commandant's like, what? You did? Okay, I'll have an officer come right over, and that's all you see. Then the next day, you see them, you see Mark Wahlberg and Tandy Wade Newton back in this sort of like flea market kind of area that you saw them before when it was empty. You also see, who's the other fellow, the third fellow? What's his name? Lee Il-sung. You see him there sort of investigating around, and he's like, what's the deal
with this empty
spot? Right, what's the deal with this empty spot? And the guy was like, oh, it belonged to a stamp collector who died after he like made a lot of money very suddenly. And he's like, aha, I get what's happening, and runs back to the hotel. Mark Wahlberg sees it, and he's like, Tandiwe, what's going on? What's going on, Tandiwe? Why is he running away from us, Tandiwe? And she's like, fuck if I know. It's so Mark Wahlberg like hightails after him. They're like squabbling.
Hilarious chase.
Right, they're like grabbing each other downstairs. You know, like, you want to see, like, one of them tie Mark Wahlberg's shoes together or something at some point.
One of the craziest parts about that, too, is the way that it's shot. It seemed like they were trying to avoid having to choreograph
a fight.
A fight, yeah.
See?
Yeah.
Right. So instead, they just film various things from Il-sung's perspective.
Right.
So you just see the camera get, like, really close up to Mark Wahlberg, and then he's like, ah, and falls back. Like, it's very funny.
I'm convinced that there's actually just one flight of stairs there, and they're
just made it look like there were multiple flights of stairs.
Going around the stairs and, like, pulling each other down the same set of stairs.
There's a scene where his chin just goes, boom, 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 boom.
But yeah, she chases after them, but much slower, because why are these men?
Yeah, like, what the fuck's going on?
What the fuck is happening?
Yeah.
And he's on the ground, like, bloodied, and Mark Wahlberg's out there, so that's...
Right, she's like, oh, something's amiss here.
Yeah, and then, so she eventually... Is this where she runs out, and Tim Robbins is there, and she's like, help!
I believe so,
Tim Robbins!
Like, yeah, Tim Robbins, you've
Mr.
helped me
Government
before, yes,
man.
Please continue to help me.
Yeah, and then... Mark Wahlberg shows up and is like, Tim Robbins.
Like, yeah, like, you're shady. What are you doing here?
This is the man that says, you've been listening to Tim Robbins?
Right.
You shouldn't listen to Tim Robbins. He's the dead guy.
Right.
Carson Dial.
And Tim Robbins is like,
Tim
you got
Robbins
me there,
is
bro.
Like, yeah, you're right.
Immediately. He doesn't put up a fight.
It's some sort of fairy thing.
Oh my God, I love
it. Right, like, curses foiled by logic again.
I love when he just says... I am Carson Tile.
My name is Carl.
It's very measured.
And so then you just basically kind of have a sort of Mexican standoff scenario happening.
But it's
with
the
like
least
the
tense version.
Right. No, I don't care for it all. But the police, like the commandant and her assistant shows up, and several other agents show up, and everyone's pointing guns at each other. Tandiwe Newton is holding up the stamps because Mark Wahlberg's like, that's what it was. The money, Charles bought expensive stamps with the money, and that's like where the money actually is. And Tandiwe Dune's like, no, fuck this shit, and throws it in a fire pit. And Mark Wahlberg's like, what? No! Tandiwe! That's the government money! And so, like, Mark Wahlberg manages to de-escalate the situation by being like, Dial, you still have your honor. Like, don't throw it all away.
What happens is he then takes the commandant
hostage, right? He's got a gun pointed at her, and Mark Wahlberg's like, no, don't do it. Like, this is the only thing you have left. Like, don't end your life like this. And Tim Robbins is like, ah, good point. And everyone throws the guns down. They take Tim Robbins off to, like, French New Wave Hannibal Lecter prison.
Where they put friends.
Yeah, where there's a French-style picture frame around
the
little slot. Yes. And so like, he's been carted off. So everything's happy there. Tandiwe Newton reveals later at the end of the movie then to Mark Wahlberg that those were not the real stamps, that she, when she called the commandant earlier, she had discovered that the stamps were valuable, and they made a copy of the stamps so that they could just use them as, like, deception, I guess.
I love that she just says, laser copy, as
right.
if you're like, sure, one of those.
Yeah, exactly. Why not? And so it turns out that she, of course, still had the stamps the entire time. She gives them back to Mark Wahlberg, who is, of course, Louis Bartholomew, an actual government agent.
Who works in the Harry Potter office.
Right, who works in the cupboard under the stairs. In the U.S. Embassy.
Literally.
I was doing the math in my head. Cary Grant get more fake names than Mark Wahlberg?
I feel like he does, but maybe...
I can't remember the other one.
Well, because the scene that I remember is at the end of Charade, where she's like, Peter, Joshua, blah, 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 and you see, like, five different shots of
Cary
Grant.
That's such a good ending.
That is such a great shot of the movie. And so... that's how it ends. You also get a brief, like, sort of end credits sequence of the old woman of Charles's mother who is apparently, I guess, working at the prison where Tim Robbins is being held, where she is delivering food to him, like his dinner to him, slides it through the slot. And as she walks away, you hear Tim Robbins going like, glug, glug, and you hear like his body collapse. And she just like looks at the camera and is like, ain't I a stinker?
And then it freezes.
Yeah. Right. And freezes. It does the little like, do, closes on her face.
He gets one more name. He gets Peter Joshua.
Right.
They reversed.
They reversed it. Yes.
Alexander Dial and Adam Canfield.
Adam Canfield.
But his
Adam,
real name okay. is Brian Cruikshank.
Cruikshank, right, which we do not get in this movie either. But we don't get Bartholomew in that movie, right? Yeah. Louis Bartholomew is not a name. I wonder if that's the name. Is Louis Bartholomew the name that Walter Matthau uses in the original movie? Or do you have it open? Do you have like the cast list open?
Yeah, it definitely is.
Okay. Because that's a familiar sounding name to me for some reason.
No.
It's not?
Yes, Carson Dial alias Hamilton Bartholomew.
Hamilton Bartholomew. Lewis. Okay, okay. That's the truth about Charlie, guys. The truth about Charlie is that he's a remake of Charade.
And he bought stamps.
And he likes stamps. So, having said all that, let's talk briefly about Charade real quick. So we've all seen Charade, I assume, right?
Yeah.
What do we think?
Not in a recent bit.
Right.
You saw
not as recently as you.
Right, I watched it last week just to sort of have it kind of fresher in my mind.
I love Charade.
Yeah, Charade's a lot of fun.
It's so much fun to watch. It looks great. It has stars that are, you know, fantastic.
I forgot that she was an interpreter in that movie, and I like that job. I like her. I remember that was the first time I'd seen that job, which I don't think we do that anymore, really.
She puts on the headset.
Right.
Yeah. Like,
well, there's like a shot where like Cary Grant like stops by to shoot. He's like, now think, like remember, like where could the buddy be? And she's like translating as he's like trying to talk to her, and like you hear the guy like saying something like behind her or like on the stage or whatever, and he says something like Friday the 5th of May, and she goes, Friday the 5th of May. No, wait a minute, it was Thursday at 8 a.m. And you see everyone like turn around and look at her and be like, what?
Yeah.
Which is just like a fun little bit of comic business. It's safe to say that we all enjoy Charade.
Very much.
Fans of Charade. You're right. There's lots of style. There's lots of charm.
It's much more silly.
Yes, it is.
In a bad way. It's like a whimsical sort of silly caper.
Yeah, it definitely dips into comedy much more than The Truth About Charlie does.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's a whole lot to cover as far as Charade goes, because as we said, it's kind of the same plot in the
broad
strokes.
Yeah.
Now we have this. We go from Charade to this. And how we get from this is, so I was doing, like I said, some research. I was taking some notes about all this. So Jonathan Demme and some friends were watching Charade, and he was commenting on the contrast between how like Stanley Donen was in France making this like sort of classic old Hollywood movie, while at the same time you have the French New Wave starting to take off while this is happening. And he just starts sort of thinking about like, oh, what would it be like if you sort of meld the two together? If you kind of like tell the story of Charade through the lens of the French New Wave aesthetic. Right. Which is not the worst idea I've ever heard someone have. Like, certainly, again, I feel like I'm probably going to use this phrase a lot, but as a thought experiment, it's a perfectly fine thing to think about. Like,
yeah.
How would you tell the story of Charade through French New Wave? Do you guys know a lot about French New Wave in general? Because my answer is no. I'm not a huge fan of French New Wave.
I used to have to. No,
right, I was going
to
say, like, I feel like much of what I know is like stuff from college.
A lot of it is, like, slice of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's
right.
A lot of, like,
it's very naturalistic,
slow, naturalistic,
sort of.
Very
yeah.
naturalistic.
Yeah.
Usually low stakes.
Yeah.
Or
yeah. They're small personal stories.
Yes.
I watched a lot of Jules and Jim.
Right, of course, Jules and Jim is, like, the big one.
Yeah, it's a lot of very, like, yeah, take it slow, have
right.
conversations.
Right.
Mumblecore.
Yeah, it does feel like Mumblecore is sort of, like, an ancestor of that. Because,
yes.
like, it's a lot of kind of, like, very sort of, like, low budget, and, like, your focus is on, like, the style and the story, not so much on something large.
There's also usually some kind of experimental element to the visual style. There's usually some kind of experimental element to how it's written or blocked or acted. There's usually a touch or a note of surreality in there.
There can be a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of film movements are sort of attached to either like a time or like a philosophy of like of the era. Like, you know, you have like
I would say it tends to be impressionistic, right?
Yeah.
Emotional.
Yeah,
it can be.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's impressionistic in style.
No.
I would say it's impressionistic in, like, trying to capture maybe a vibe.
Yeah.
Or a feeling more than you're trying to capture, like, a sequential story.
Right, and I mean, it's definitely sort of, like, a response to Hollywood cinema, mm-hmm. where it's sort of like, if you take into account that Hollywood tends to be sort of like big and expensive with like huge stars.
But also structured.
Right. This is supposed to be sort of much more like freewheeling, loosey-goosey, and dealing with things in perhaps a more like grounded mm-hmm. or interpersonal manner mm-hmm. than you might expect from a sort of big budget style movie. That is my understanding of what French New Wave mostly covers. I could be very wrong, because again, as I said, it's not a genre that I...
This is helpful.
Like that much. What do you got?
Existential themes is how it's often described.
Existential themes,
Stressing the individual and the acceptance of the absurdity of human existence.
Yeah, that's definitely
irony and sarcasm.
There. Yeah,
yeah.
So yeah, that's the vibe you're getting.
Yeah, that's definitely a big part of it. Yes.
It's definitely a lot of like people sitting around in cafes
smoking. Yes. Yes.
Right. Even before you started to say the words, I was already
talking about life. Already...
Yes. Yeah. That's definitely yeah. Like I said, it's a lot of smaller stories, like small scale stories focusing on the people more than like some sort of adventure or something that they might be going on.
Which is why it's a challenging task to marry the sensibility to a very plotty and complicated story like Charade.
Right. So the other thing I would throw out there real quick is there's a lot that this movie takes from Shoot the Piano Player, mm-hmm. which I have seen once, like years ago, and cannot claim to remember it super well. But from what I do recall of it, it is very easy to watch this movie and see how it was influenced by that in terms of aesthetics, vibes, that sort of thing. Again, as I said, French New Wave is not really my thing. It's not something that I tend to really enjoy, so I don't watch all that much. But like Shoot the Piano Player is a very easy movie to watch. It's a very, like we said before, sort of a vibes heavy film. But
this is like reading about it. It just specifically calls out like Godot did things that people didn't do at the time, like having characters like look directly to camera and address the audience. And say, which we see
which you do a lot.
They don't necessarily and, address the audience, right, but well, they do look at you a lot.
Well, there was the one part where the soldier at the end like looks at the camera and shrugs.
Right.
I mean, a lot of that, to be fair, is a Jonathan Demme sort of thing. That Jonathan Demme loves shots of characters looking directly into the camera, which you get a lot of in here.
Yeah. It felt like it was an overdrive in this movie.
Yes. Anyway, just like briefly on like Shoot the Piano Player. I remember it being a relatively easy watch. If it's something that you're interested in, it goes down pretty smooth. And it's like, it's entertaining.
Yeah.
It's a simple, straightforward story. And like,
it's kind of episodic.
And
like
I mean,
vignettes that all kind of assemble to
right. And like, I just remember there's like one part that I really like. The one thing I really remember is where like one of like the gangsters is talking to a kid, and the gangster's like talking about his scarf, and he's like, "It's not made of fabric, you know. It's made of metal." And the kid's like, "No, it's not. It's definitely made of fabric." He's like, "It's made of metal. It's from Japan." The kid's like, "This is made of fabric. Like, why are you lying to me?" And the gangster goes like, "I am not lying to you. If I am lying to you, may my mother drop dead." And they cut away to like this old woman, like in a house, and all of a sudden she goes like, and falls backward dead. And they just cut back to the, like the gangster in the car, which is such a great, like, it truly is. Like, it almost feels like Monty Python or something in its surreality. So like, there's a lot of stuff to like in movies like that, even if like me, it's not something you go to all that often.
I tend to find it more palatable when it is being more humorous.
I agree.
I think it can feel very pretentious when it goes in a more serious direction.
So looking at that sort of thing, then you have to take into account where Jonathan Demme was coming from. So he had worked with Tandy Wei Newton on the movie Beloved, which I have not seen, which is an adaptation of the Toni Morrison.
I think it's supposed to be good, though.
I've heard it's supposed to be like as good an adaptation as one could ever hope to have of Beloved.
Yeah, it's an intense book.
Right. And like, I think Tandy Wei Newton kind of makes sense as an Audrey Hepburn type character
saying, but for the delicate features, she's very petite. There's a similar vibe happening here because she does have this sort of almost like a highborn, suave vibe.
Right. She comes across as like a very sort of like upper class type woman.
Yes, very much.
She carries across this like idea of like somebody who's like naive, like innocent but not naive character.
Yes.
Somebody who's like, I don't know what's happening, but I'm not like
a fucking idiot. I'm not stupid. Right, like I may not be able to piece this all together, but I know that someone's fucking with me right now. Yeah. And so there is a whole quote I had taken from an interview that IGN did with Jonathan Demme. And he said, I had a great vehicle for Tandiwe Newton that could really introduce this incredible young actress who can hold her own with any actresses out there. There was never any question of anyone else playing the part. As for Wahlberg, Demme recalls with a laugh, I had a t-shirt that had a picture of Cary Grant in a big red circle with a line through his face. I told him to forget Cary Grant. I referred to Mark as anti-Cary Grant. People said, this would be great for George Clooney. And I was like, well, yeah, if you want to get into a contest, you know, can Clooney do Cary Grant? But that didn't interest me. As a consumer, it would interest me to see that. But as a filmmaker, I didn't want to do that. Now, again, if we're going back to thought experiments and we're going back to things that make sense on paper, I understand this.
I understand where he's coming yes. from, but that still doesn't make Mark Wahlberg.
No, sense. I quite agree with you. Again, my thought would be like, while, you know, Tandiwe Newton makes a lot of sense as a modern day Audrey Hepburn type, this is not necessarily who I would think would step into the
room. I'm going to say a really yeah. hot take right now.
Yeah, say it.
I don't think, maybe not in 2002 because I don't know the ages lined yeah. up, but you know who could have done it? Who? If you wanted an anti-Cary Grant type, who could have done it better? Jeremy Renner. I'm going to say it.
What, interesting.
How old would he have been at the time? He would have been like 20, like, right?
Probably quite young
yeah.
for the role. But.
Yeah. Because he would have definitely been younger than Tandiwe Newton, I'm pretty sure.
I mean, that would have been an interesting yeah. reversal.
That's true. It would be interesting to have an older woman and a younger man.
I'm just saying looks and like type-wise.
I think if you wanted a Mark Wahlberg type, you probably want Jeremy Renner instead.
I think that Jeremy Renner looks more threatening. If you yeah. still look more threatening.
Yeah. We were spitballing a bunch of people, but
well, we'll get to that part yeah. later because okay. I do want to get to that. But I just want, so like, again, if you think about this as like a post Boogie Nights kind of world, Mark Wahlberg makes like a little bit of sense as like someone who's kind of starting to pop and we're not quite sure what to do with him.
We don't necessarily know what he's good at.
Right. I see what they did do too, because if you look at the way that the character's done in the movie, they de-glamorize the role a bit
right.
because mm-hmm. at the end, like, Bartholomew's office is like in the
basement.
In the yeah. basement. Yeah. It's got like no window. It's like tiny. It's like under the stairs, right. like Harry Potter yes. style. So it's,
he has a fridge it, yeah. and a small yeah. TV combo VCR.
So he's not like a sort of like sexy government.
Right, like he's like not, yeah. Clerk. I the movie I think very wisely realizes that he cannot play Cary Grant, so yeah. you have to rethink who this character is. No, that's true. I mean, this the thing about Mark Wahlberg is obviously he's much better at playing, like, I don't know, a guy from Southie than he is from playing, like, yeah. someone who lives in Paris.
I do still think that even if you wanted him to not be, like, the type of Cary Grant,
mm-hmm.
it has to be somebody who's comfortable to doing a lot of different
modes,
right? And like code switching,
yes,
and things like
that. Yes.
And I don't think that Mark Wahlberg demonstrates
no,
that.
No, I think like the only thing I can say, I guess, that is a credit to his casting is that it's very easy to not trust him at any given yeah. point because he always seems like a kid who's just playing a role, you know, like at almost any given point it's sort of like,
I mean,
I think you're lying to me.
You sort of have to describe these expressions he makes where it looks like he just kind of pouts a lot throughout the movie,
yeah,
like where he sees that woman he doesn't like the look of and he's just like
no, it's like a dog or something. It's like when yeah, you're like mean yeah. to a dog or, and I was like
I thought it was so funny when Tandiwe is like buying her ticket out of there and he's trying to convince her to stay, and then they do both of them a like into camera mega close up,
yeah,
but and like on her it's like fine, she's giving us suspicion, she's giving us oh I'm wavering, but then with him,
oh
it's
God.
Just like
right.
jokey,
it's just,
like,
yeah, it's just like this dumb little kid just staring into the camera and being like
huh? I believe that is intentional, at least on everyone's part, like it was supposed to be an unsettling maybe, I don't know, but
maybe
it's,
I mean they do it a lot.
I would buy it if it was intentional, but like
yeah
it's because the thing is like, as I said, anyone at that angle, at that close angle with that smile, I don't care who you are, I don't care how much charisma
right.
you lose,
you're not
I'm
yeah.
creeped out by that.
Yeah.
Get a back up.
It's too close.
Right.
Step 5 feet.
Yeah. And I agree. So yeah, agree. So again, I think if that is like an intentional thing that the movie is trying to play,
yeah.
then it's done a very good job at making you look at this guy's face and his attitude and be like, no, no, don't listen
yeah.
to what he's saying.
You're
get
still,
on the train.
You're still in a job where you have to pretend to be other people and do a lot of different things. So you'd have to be able to speak a lot of languages and do a lot. I just don't believe that Mark Wahlberg is doing that.
I don't either. Not at all. He's simply not that convincing in this position.
Yeah.
Like,
he doesn't come off as savvy.
Yeah. No, I mean, again, like, he's very good at, like, I think he works good when he's playing, like, a scrappy guy with a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah.
But, like, that is not who this character is. And I don't even know how you would reconceive this character
for
to be
him.
That.
I
because,
know.
Like, this character, like, his character has to have a certain amount of, like, an air of control over the entire situation where, yeah, like, he knows more than almost anyone else, yeah, in this movie. And he has to be comfortable that when, like, someone calls him out on his bullshit, he has to immediately have in his back pocket, like, oh, well, I'm sorry I lied to you. I'm actually this. And this is why I couldn't tell you the truth about who I was. But, like, now I'm telling you the truth, and this is why you should believe me that I'm telling the truth.
Another interesting thing you could have done, but the movie didn't do, and I don't know if it would have time to do it, but you could have done an interesting take on this character where it's really not part of his job description to be going out in the field and being right. Honest.
Yeah.
That was something.
And he's just sort of done this all on his own.
Right.
Right.
I had thought about that too.
And this is just his first attempt at, like, well, I mean, I know all the people involved. I've done all the paperwork. I know all these names in my head.
I think that's what I was thinking about. If gun to my head, I had to reconfigure this figure to be more fitting for Mark Wahlberg. I think what I decide to do is he's a hothead who is maybe very low-level agent, somehow got some kind of information and was like, oh, I'm gonna fucking save the day, man. And but it needs to be more boisterous. It needs to be more out loud dumb, not just in the face dumb.
Yeah, I almost wonder if, like, if he wasn't switching identities so much, would this work better for him too?
Yes.
You know, if he wasn't, like, trying to portray a character who's, like, cool and suave, if instead from the get-go he's immediately kind of presenting himself as sort of like this underdog type character, and then you still of course can find out that he's, like, lying about who he really is,
right,
but it's still more or less the same persona that he's putting on, maybe that would have fared better. I don't know. I don't know if that makes a better movie, but it might make a better Mark Wahlberg performance.
Let's hop in this time machine and find out.
Great.
Yeah. So back and find out.
I think also kind of going off of that, it's kind of an issue sort of because there's, like, no real chemistry between the two of them in this movie. And also, I mean, to be fair, also, this movie doesn't really seem like it's interested in the romantic aspect as much as the original Charade is.
But it's sort of baked into the
right
plot.
It's an intrinsic part of its DNA, so, like, you have to have it in there if you're going to tell the story in this way.
I guess if you wanted to retell it without it, that's fine, but they don't. Like, it is there.
Right.
So it's, like, it's just a weird thing because you're right. You don't feel anything when they're together. I feel like a lot of times Tandy Wade Newton is, like, giving the role so much emotional layers. She's doing so much with her face. And I think she just got a scene partner who could not meet her there.
Yeah.
I mean, they kind of shifted too, because, like, in the original Charade, it really, like, romance was, they wanted it to be like a comedy romance. And they were like, yeah, I want you to team up. And, like, Cary Grant was like, well, I don't want to,
I'm too old. Yeah.
And she was like, well, we'll just have Audrey Hepburn be really horny for you.
Yeah.
Right.
And it plays out like that, and that's baked into the plot. And this movie is kind of, it's not like the reverse, but, like, it definitely, like, is more on his end.
Right.
Because he's the one at the end that is like, wait, but I love you. I know that I was lying to you a lot, but I did actually like you. Please stay.
You spend most of the time feeling like there's no way on earth this woman should be reciprocating. And she kind of doesn't.
Right.
It's a much harder sell if the guy is the one that has to. If she's interested in him by the end, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great that you've already moved. She's already moved past all that.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Right.
You have to move past it. But it's a harder ending to have to write and sell if he has to sell her on him. After he's lying.
Right, like, he's the one who has to convince her to stay.
Yeah.
Versus we're in the original Charade. She's me like, oh, it's you again.
She's like
shall we get married?
I'm done with all you. Like, whatever. Tell me what your real name is.
Yeah.
Pick one.
Yeah.
And I'll marry that one.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
I don't care.
Tell me what's right on the marriage certificate.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah. But yeah, because then by the end, you're just like, Antonio Wayne Newton goes to leave, and you're like, I get it.
Should. Like, yeah. So I would also say, kind of going off of that, this movie feels like it struggles with tone, which, you know, we had said obviously that the romance feels like it doesn't quite work in this. But whereas the original Charade is kind of doing a tripod of, like, thriller, romance, and comedy,
mm-hmm.
this one is mostly just kind of a straightforward thriller for the most part.
Yeah, it's mostly a thriller. There are moments that are genuinely funny.
No, there are. Yeah,
we all genuinely.
Right. There are, like, yeah, there are intentional comic moments that are indeed quite funny because, like, Jonathan Demme's not a fucking idiot. Like,
right.
He knows what a movie is.
It does feel like it sort of comes out of nowhere, and we don't, like, we've lost one leg of the tripod, right? So
yeah.
Really what we get functionally is a very slow thriller that has occasionally very funny moments.
Yeah. It's also interesting that because I remember, Chris, whenever we were talking about doing this movie like a couple weeks ago or whatever, mm-hmm. and you had, like, I think you were just like flipping through Wikipedia at the time, and you had just said that Jonathan Demme wanted to use the tagline, "When in doubt, laugh."
Yes.
Which is insane, because there is so little like comment. Like, that right. makes sense as a tagline for Charade.
Right.
That does not make sense for this. So I'm really curious as to why Jonathan Demme thought that, like, "When in doubt, laugh" is a great line for this.
What a genuinely upsetting scene when the lady soldier is dying.
Yeah, yeah.
She's just standing, Tandy Newton standing over crying, her being like, "Oh my God, don't worry."
Right.
Like,
yeah, we'll get help. We'll get help. Yeah,
gonna die.
Yeah,
but she's like, "Oh, we're gonna call an ambulance," yeah. and just like waiting with her until the light goes out of her
eyes. Right, she's like bleeding from orifices, yeah. and like.
And the thing is, maybe Jonathan Demme set out to make a more comedic version, which would have been great, because that would have been very true to what he was adapting, while right. much more enjoyable to watch. But I feel like that's just not the movie we got.
I mean,
if it were more heightened in terms of its tone, maybe, but...
French New Wave knew how to be funnier like that, too. Like, there are bits that I think work where, like...
Right.
The thing that I think is intentional is that we laughed at... When she's being interviewed by the cops in the beginning, there's like they're in a glass office.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And at one point, for some reason, it's like shot to shot, like when they cut back to like behind
a wide shot of the commandant. Yeah.
That like suddenly there are just two people unrelated to this, just
drinking like, coffee, like looking at the window, being like
At the interrogation. Yeah. And it's funny. Why are they there? Like, yeah. It's in the background. It's not. It's lampshaded. You're just not supposed to like. So you're just looking at it. Like it's you notice it, and it's funny that there are just people right. staring at you and like. A goldfish. There are yeah. things that they don't do it. They're wasted opportunities. Like the scene in the Ferris wheel.
Yeah.
is played like a straight thriller scene, like mm-hmm. very serious. Like she gets in with Tim Robbins. They have a conversation that cannot be overheard about all the secret bullshit
via uncomfortable close-ups.
Via uncomfortable close-ups. But there's so much opportunity for there to be, like, an obnoxious kid rocking in the one behind
right,
him.
Yeah.
Or something happening, some kind of business happening.
Yeah.
But nothing ever happens.
You know what I think this kind of needed? It needed either Mark Wahlberg or Tandy Wade Newton to be given a character that was more effusive. You can't both be the cool one. Someone needs to be there to give some energy.
I mean, I think Tandy Wade Newton is trying to do that. Like, I don't think she's trying to play it like cool, because obviously she is like the one in peril for much of the movie.
I guess what I'm trying to say is she kind of is more of the straight man. And I think one of these people needed to be the comedy, because especially if it were her in that moment, then she could just be like, "Oh my God, what a fun ride. Oh, we're like getting such a great view from here." But as it is, it's too serious for that tagline to even fit.
I think they can both be serious, but the world can be absurd.
Right, yes. Yeah, like, I think that's more of like a French New Wave vibe.
You know how like Ferris will just sort of stop randomly sometimes?
Yeah.
If somebody didn't get out at the right time, like if they just kept doing that.
If they're just like rocking like back and forth, like yeah. Just sort of wait, or like even just sort of like she wants to get out, but they're still like 20 feet above and she's just like...
Yeah.
All right.
They're just like looking at their watch. Yeah. It just cuts away. Like we don't get to see them actually get up because they have to wait.
Yeah.
It does make me wonder if there was a more openly comedic version of this movie Once Upon a Time, and that just like they went away from that.
I just think that he, I don't know, was like torn between doing this thriller and imitating a specific movie that he liked, and didn't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It does sort of show like the peril of trying to filter one thing through another thing, because then it does, you know, you do end up like losing that sort of spark that the original story might have had, because you're filtering it through something completely different that was not organically there in the first place. Which is not to say you can't do it, just that it's very difficult to do.
Yeah, I think if you're starting with just like, "I want to do a remake of Charade, and I want to send up French New Wave." Fine.
Yeah.
It's not really what French New Wave films are about usually,
right.
but fine.
Right.
Try to work in some vibes of French New Wave. But then I think that invoking a specific movie is a bridge too far.
I would agree. The fact that he's very into Shoot the Piano Player feels at a certain point that it just sort of, this movie just kind of ends up being an homage to Shoot the Piano Player and less of, I don't know, anything else, kind of.
It made me wish that he had just decided to just do like a style exercise in French New Wave and just not try to tell this story with that lens. Not that it can't be done or that you shouldn't try. I really appreciate that he was trying to do something unexpected here. I think that's really cool in theory, but I just think that the style doesn't really work best with that kind of story, but I would have loved to have seen this work.
Yeah.
Like, what I did see work made me feel like, this just isn't the right story for this.
Also, yeah. Also, like, it's tough because it's, like, a remake of a movie from, like, the 60s.
Yeah.
But it's evoking a style of very close to that time, but also it does take place in 2002.
Right.
Yeah. And so some of the humor is very specific to 2002 in a way that I think... Maybe you should have just made...
I was on this one, a period piece.
A period piece. Yeah. Yeah, but like, or made it more, just get rid of the French thing and just make it modern. Because I like the humor that comes out of the cell phone thing where she's like watching, she's trying to trip Alexander Dyslop.
Right. Yeah, this
is so good. She's like outside calling him.
From like on a store phone being like, hey, can you find Alexander Dial?
Like watching him answer the phone to the English Dial. She starts running into the store and they're arguing over the phone and it... They argue up to the point that she's like staring, is on the phone, just staring him in the face, yelling at him through the phone.
Yeah, it's so funny.
It is. It is good. Yeah. And then the clerk is like, and your package. Just like, they're sort of staring at each other. And she's just like, and the gift you bought.
Yeah. Have it. So there's like stuff like that. I'm like, that's a scene you can only have in this time period.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it feels like we're in the 70s because I'm being tricked by film at the time.
You rascal.
There is a very 70s just like look.
Yeah. Well, because he wants us to feel like we're in the 70s.
Right. I think, yeah, you do want a sort of like something that is mimicking the feel of like the, you know, mid 60s, early 70s. Yeah.
It did it for good, bad, and indifferent.
Excuse me. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing that I would say also really trips you up is that Jonathan Demme seems very interested in using like different kinds of cameras at various points.
Oh my god. The, can we talk about the unintentionally funny bit at the beginning?
What? Which one?
Where?
Oh yeah, swipe.
When Mark Wahlberg and Teddy Newton are meeting for the first time.
Yeah.
And there are close-ups of their faces, but like it starts from like the far
like left to the right, and it's moving. Goes,
and
yeah.
The camera is just as they're talking, saying a line, it just sort of pans from left to right over their face.
Yes.
And then it'll cut to Teddy Newton and put the left to the right of her face.
Yes.
And it does this for at least 4 shots.
Yes.
And I'm like, I need that to happen for like 8 more shots.
And then when it cuts to the next scene, it's a side swipe.
Yes. Yes.
Like
it
it's
is.
A side wipe, rather. It's a side wipe transition. It's so funny.
Yeah. And it's just that, it's first of all, it's hilarious how horribly disorienting it is because they're quite short, these shots.
Yes. Yeah.
But, and every time your framing is being reset to like the far
to
left.
Where it was. Yeah.
Dark.
Originally.
Dark.
Dark.
Yeah.
Dark. You're like.
It's like a copy machine. It's like
it's like a copy machine.
That's a good. I mean, there's a lot of like flashy, you know, camera tricks in this movie, and like I also like I think like some of the shots seem like they're done on like a very very early digital camera or something. Like I think some of the shots of like the war scenes look like they're done that, and I think like there's a flashback scene. I think it's like the flashback scene where you see Ted Levine dying and realize that he saw Tim Robbins. It looks like it's a standard def digital camera or something almost.
Yeah,
so like it just seems like Jonathan Demme was like very into like, oh, what sort of fun can I have with the technology that's available to me at this point?
He changed up lenses sometimes too. Like there was one or two shots where Tandy Wee Newton looks out the little peephole in her hotel door and you see like Mark Wahlberg's face is all like distorted.
Well, it's supposed to be through like the peephole, right?
Right.
Like, yeah.
So, I mean, he still had to achieve that.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Some kind of lens.
I see what you mean. Yeah. Just to like comment again, like I guess briefly on tone, we had talked about this a little bit, but again, the scene where what's her fucking face, the woman soldier, what's her name,
Lola, yeah,
where Lola is dying, like so there's the scene where she's hit by the car and it's played as like a very emotional scene, but like we don't really know this character. Tandy Wayne Newton doesn't really know this character except for in the scene prior, Lola is dancing with her and Lola's like, I thought you were kind of a bitch before, but now I think you're hot and I have a crush on you. Yeah. And Tandy Wayne Newton's like, oh, that's cool. And so then you see her dying and Tandy Wee Newton's like crying, which like I guess, you know, arguably you could just be crying because like someone is dying in front of you, which is like, you know,
I mean, a jarring thing. I'm sort of fine with that. I don't think it makes sense in this movie that we're supposed to think is a comedy.
Right.
But I mean, I think it makes sense in a movie where it's like, this is somebody who's been chasing me, but now they've been humanized because
we have this extreme person,
and I'm just now the person is dying.
Yeah.
She's not used to seeing people die, probably.
No, I feel like that has to be like the read of the scene. The read of the scene is less that it's, you know, someone I'm close to and more just like seeing this person dying is traumatic to me.
Yeah.
And I think also like it sort of has to be said, those like the three idiots who are following her around, like it does feel like Jonathan Demme likes them too much for them to be outright. Because in the original movie, they're kind kind of more villains.
Yeah, they're just like,
well, and you cycle through them.
Right, they're like cartoon quickly, characters, because it's like you got like the thuggish guy with the hook for a hand, right. And you've got a cowboy, and you've got like this little nervous guy.
Yeah.
And here it seems like Jonathan Demme just likes them too much and like wants them to kind of be likable, interesting.
Well, I mean,
I'm not saying he's wrong to like them.
Oh, I mean, I love them, but I do think that's a thing. He uses them way more in this movie than the goons pop up in Charade, and they get humanized significantly.
Right, well, yeah. I mean, he's definitely more interested in humanizing them. And like, even, there are elements that I kind of really like about that. Like, you have the one scene where after, I think it's after Ted Levine has died on the train, and the police officer is just like, so someone fucking died of a heart attack and you idiots are all here. Great. Get out. We will figure this out. And the next shot is all of them like in a restaurant, mm-hmm. and Tandiwe Newton is like dumping her bags on the table, being like, this is everything I have. Dig through this. Tell me where the money could possibly be. And so it's just like her and Mark Wahlberg and the other two soldiers just like digging through all this shit. And it's like, I kind of wish there was more of that. Like, I kind of wish that it became like a reluctant team up, maybe between them.
Like, here, newsflash, bozos, I don't want this happening to me.
Yes, right.
So we're going to figure this out
right,
right now.
Like, yeah, the sooner you're out of my life, the happier I am. Let's do this. Yeah. Yeah. Which, like, I think could be, like, again,
if it would have done more comically, that would have been hilarious.
Absolutely. Yeah, that too. Or again, like, if you want to humanize the characters, I think that's a good way of doing it. Like, forcing them to sort of, like, see each other as people and not just as, like, cartoon characters with hooks for hands popping up behind you being like, I want your money, give me your money. So, you know, that's definitely something that's kind of there, but perhaps not quite there to the extent that I would want it to be, maybe. I'll just comment briefly on the plotting before we kind of move on here. So we had talked about this briefly, but the thing about French New Wave movies versus these movies is French New Wave movies tend to have sort of very simple, straightforward stories so that they can function as exercises in styles or characters, personalities, that sort of thing. So whereas like Shoot the Piano Player is a very kind of straightforward story about like a sad guy who meets a woman, finds out that shit's happening to his brothers, and then is like, oh no, how will I, you know, how will I prevent this from interfering with my life? Charade is the antithesis of that. Charade is like an insanely tightly plotted movie that has so much going on at any given point that almost any time you stop to have like these weird little character beats, it kind of feels like it smacks you in the face again as soon as the plot starts going into full gear, which just feels like that alone was like a big mistake in kind of trying to adapt Charade in through a French New Wave lens. Like, it's simply like the two things simply cannot go together because Charade has so many plates that it's spinning.
I think the one way I could imagine this working, potentially, would be if you decided that the plot is intentionally incomprehensible, and it of itself is a comment on how overcomplicated thrillers
are. Right, I mean, again, I feel like we talked about this, but like almost a burn after reading style thing, where at the end the characters are like, boy, I can't make sense of any of this shit that just happened here.
But I kind of love that when it's done well, anyway.
Yeah. The other brief thing, just talk about that, is like Shoot the Piano Player is also like, because it's a French New Wave movie, it's kind of like trying to take the piss out of what like a Hollywood movie actually is for something like that. And like, Charlie is not really trying to do that for the most part. Like, it's like there are certainly like style elements, and you know, the scenes like how it presents Paris as sort of like a very realistic, grounded, gritty place, and not like this sort of like romantic playground that it often is, that certainly feel like they're along the lines of what a lot of French New Wave did. But then for the most part, it's also kind of a standard boilerplate sort of thriller movie. Right. So it's sort of like an uneasy marriage between the two in that respect, I guess. The most radical thing, I guess, it does is like casting Mark Wahlberg as an anti-Cary Grant, you know?
And like, I guess putting what funny moments there are in what is otherwise a very standard thriller.
Yeah.
That's shot interestingly, for sure, but is not, in terms of how it's structured, really that different.
Right. Briefly, I guess we can just throw out any sort of like characters that we want to go into real quick, or like the casting. So I don't know. Do you have anything to say about Tandiwe Newton Regina?
I think she does, between the two leads, she's my pick for the best.
I mean, she's doing yeoman's work for a lot of this. There's a few moments I don't like where I feel like she goes very, very big, which I assume must have been intentional and like the direction.
Maybe.
Where like, I think it's where she's like meeting with Tim Robbins by the river.
Oh,
and like Tim Robbins like pops out of the door, just goes like, really huge all of a sudden. It's like, that doesn't feel like the sort of thing that this woman would do.
That's true. But otherwise, I think she's reacting to things really naturally. I think she's hitting the emotional beats really strongly.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm kind of bummed that this wasn't a better movie for her to break out in, you know?
I think all of the people in this movie can act. I think that Tandiwa Newton's one of the few people who is well cast.
I would agree with that.
That's a great way to put it.
I think that's a good point. Yeah, again, like also worth like Tim Robbins, whom I like a lot.
He just doesn't fit.
It's a little, because he's also definitely like, it feels like he's really doing a Walter Matthau impression for a lot of it. Like he's kind of almost doing a voice to a point.
It's such a bizarre voice.
It's an insane kind of voice. It's an insane choice to make. Yeah. But it's also like I was saying when watching this, the difference between the two also is that Walter Matthau is kind of like this like schlubby blue collar guy from New York who you don't think is necessarily like a villain or a threat because he looks so average. Whereas Tim Robbins is like 7 feet tall,
this huge guy
with like a very like sort of serious look. Like there's just something about
him scowling the whole
thing. Yeah, right. There's something about this just like very physically intimidating.
Yeah.
Whereas with Walter Matthau looks kind of like, I don't know, like your uncle or something. Right. You know, it's like you wouldn't expect this guy to secretly be a villain. Whereas with Tim Robbins, it's like, well, there's something very shady about you from the start here.
Right, which is why it's not at all a surprise when he's like, I'm the main villain.
You're right.
Like, okay.
Yeah, I guess. That makes sense.
Fine.
Should have thought of that.
Fits.
Yeah. I mean, Mark Wahlberg as everyone. Anything to say?
As everyone.
So I had commented, but I don't think I saw it here. This was supposed to be Will Smith. Will Smith was supposed to play this part.
Which I think would have been better. Although still, I think you could get better.
Right. It probably wouldn't have worked perfectly, but it's a better choice.
Yeah, I don't think either are what you want for this role.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about that.
I think it's not working what he's doing. I don't think that's entirely his fault. I don't have a high estimation of his acting.
I don't really either. And I mean, like, again, like there are actors who are very good in narrow parameters, right, and like playing a certain type of character. Mark Wahlberg is not that actor. You know, he's not good in this part, but it's not entirely his fault that he's not good in this part because it just shouldn't have probably happened as written.
I think he tries.
He's certainly trying. He's certainly wearing his dopey little beret, carrying his paper bag with a baguette coming out of it.
The beret was so dumb.
So many baguette bags.
it's a very heavy baguette bag movie. So also, I guess, I mean, anything else you want to say about actors real quick? I like the people who played like the three soldiers.
Me too.
They're fun.
I think they're great.
I think that the guy who plays the Korean soldier should have been Charlie.
He's phenomenal. The Mark Wahlberg character. Yeah. And the rest.
Mark Wahlberg character.
Yeah. No, he's very likable.
He looks good and he looks like someone you could trust,
right,
who might kill you.
Right, yeah, he has like the equal balance of like charm and terrifying.
I love that moment when Lola flips around, just grabs a guy by his junk and
like
slams him against the lockers.
Yeah.
Such a crazy moment.
Yeah.
I also just love seeing Ted Levine. He has such a good villain goon face.
Truly.
It was, I don't know whose genius idea it was to just laden him with odd medical things.
Yeah.
But fantastic.
He just has like, he's got like EKG thing hooked up to his body. It's taped onto him somehow.
Yeah.
And then he's got random.
He has the needles. What are the fucking needles called?
Acupuncture.
He's got like, he's got like two or three needles. And like, there's a scene where like, it's never addressed.
No.
But he's just like talking to them and he turns around. Right. And you see like these needles like bouncing along the side of his face. And they're just in there. So just, I guess, to go briefly before we get into fixes as a sort of transition to this, we had talked about, you know, again, how Will Smith was supposed to play this role. And then we were also talking about, like, who we thought might be better in the Mark Wahlberg role. So just to sort of kick out some ideas there, you guys had both said, Chris, I believe, you had said Denzel?
I said Denzel. He probably would have been my number one choice.
Yeah. Denzel feels like a very good choice.
I think it's a pretty good middle point, too, because obviously the age difference is not as severe as it was in the original Charade, but he is still a little older than Tandiwa Newton, and he's an incredibly versatile actor who can play both very charming but very threatening when he needs to. And I think he could handle the different character or identity transitions with a little more oomph.
Right, yes. And Lee, you had said Ralph Fiennes as an option.
I did, yeah.
Which also feels like, again, a good choice. He's British, he has, like, equal...
But he can do...
He's handsome, but he's also, like...
He's British, but he can do that. He can bring up that sleazy American accent he did in that one movie what we watched.
The one movie what we watched?
The one that takes place in 1999, but it's spooky cyberpunk LA.
Yeah, I fucking freak. Shit. Strange Days?
Strange Days.
Yeah.
So we know he has that accent in the pocket.
In his pocket,
which makes him sound kind of sleazy.
Strange Days.
I love Strange Days.
What a picture.
It's such a fucking weird movie.
What a picture.
So, like, the three ones that I had kind of thought about, and I mean, George Clooney is kind of the given for everyone at this point. We all agree that George Clooney is probably, like, everyone's idea yeah, as to what this would be. But I see what Jonathan Demme exactly. means from the sense that, like, as a filmmaker, it's not very exciting to cast, like, the most obvious, safest choice for the role.
A little expected.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And, like, while I'm sure George Clooney would have been very good in it, I get why you might be averse to that. The three names that I had thought of, all who were actors who were sort of, like, that was the whole challenge to you, like, actors who were active at the time, who could conceivably have been, you know... asked to audition. Daniel Craig.
Oh, I could so see that.
Colin Farrell.
Colin Farrell would knock us out of the park.
Yeah, and Hugh Jackman.
Hugh Jackman?
Yeah.
Hugh Jackman.
Yes, it's Hugh Jackman.
I could... Oh, gosh. Hugh Jackman and... Who came before that?
Colin Farrell.
Colin Farrell. Those have been really interesting choices at the time, right? Because... Right.
They were kind of popping, but they weren't, like, huge names. Right. At the point. I mean, Hugh Jackman, I guess, this is
This is
post-X-Men, so, like, he would have been known. But
had that first of the Irish movies come out where he played the one about Belgrade or Bell something.
What?
What? What one?
Oh, man, these are movies that exist.
I'm sure they are. I can't...
Colin Farrell, him and another Irish guy that they did another movie together that I saw.
In Bruges, of
Inisherin.
In Bruges,
yeah.
When did In Bruges come out?
After this, yeah. In Bruges was definitely after this.
Okay.
With Brendan Gleeson.
Brendan Gleeson.
Yes.
With just random cities because I knew it started with a B.
Right.
Yeah.
Brussels. I don't know.
And close.
The sequel.
Brussels yeah. is close to Bruges.
The sequel. All right. So having covered some potential other choices for this, as long as we're peeping through the curtain to that alternate universe where another version of this movie exists, yeah. What do you guys have in the way of fixes?
I didn't find this movie super inspirational, but I did pull enough out of it. It was really interesting because I really like Jonathan Demme as a director, and this may be the first time I've watched something of his and been like, wow, not great. Not great, John.
You didn't see what was the Wallace Shawn movie, Architect? What was the fucking...
Oh my God, The Master?
Yeah, The Master, Master Builder.
Master Builder, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm desperate to after that episode of Blank Check. Anyway. Yeah.
Anyway.
So this might also be somewhat influenced by how we watched Domino recently, but in a broader sense, I see Charade, if you want to update it, my way to do that is to make it a very intentional spoof and satire on spy fiction. And I think one of the things that, or spy thrillers or whatever, what have you. And we've seen it plenty in doing this pod. We've seen this plenty in other movies where there's we're starting at the end when someone's being interrogated and then the whole movie is them like telling this story, right? I want to use that as a framework. I want to have each individual person involved kind of being, like, debriefed by the government to figure out, like, what the fuck happened. And I think each of these people has a complementary but conflicting story or version of the story. You can get away with some kind of, like, fun genre shifts, right? So I think, assuming it's still Mark Wahlberg, I think the perspective there is that this is some kind of, like, low-level grunt who, like, way jumped the gun and kind of went off. And so maybe his tale is more of a, like, rah-rah action story or something like that, or like where he's the most amazing spy that ever was. Maybe Tandy Wee Newton's story is kind of more of a like weird Sleeping with the Enemy style drama of like, did I know my husband? Did I get fucked over? I think the story that the soldiers tell can be, you know, and what I want to have this all be is they are all telling stories that are intentionally confusing and conflicting. Basically, the government's just like, well, shrug. I guess we can't really hold you guys on anything. And
that's how the government works.
I know, I'm aware.
You've got us.
You can't make our mind up. You're
all free.
Us.
Well, just like they were able to elude.
Yeah. No, I again, like nothing adds up to the point
that
they can't.
It's that first draft of like, and then something crazy happens, and the government can't figure out what to do.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so I wanted to be like, they're all let go, and this was done intentionally so they could split the money and go their separate
That's
ways.
That's fun.
So you're doing like a Rashomon.
Yeah. But like comedic Rashomon.
Yeah, I mean, I was also like, I thought like Usual Suspects almost in the story, where someone's manipulating the entire thing, but like more of a fun, you know.
Yeah, I want it to be fun. I'm kind of over this whole like, can you believe, because it's very played out, the Kaiser Soze reveal.
What?
So sorry. Spoilers for a 50-year-old movie? 40-year-old movie? I don't know.
It was from like the 90s.
Was it?
Yeah, The Usual Suspects.
The 90s was Bryan Singer. Years ago.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they were 90. 1990 was 90 years ago. Yeah. That's how you can remember.
All right, I can go next.
Go. Yeah.
Free ballin'.
Put it away, Lee.
I'm going to take this further than, what is his name? Demi?
Jonathan Demme.
Jonathan Demme?
Yeah.
I'm taking it further than he took it. So he wanted to cast an anti-George Clooney.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do enough with that. So he cast Mark Wahlberg. I'm not casting Mark Wahlberg anymore because I'm doing it further. It's no longer Mark Wahlberg. But I think if you cast someone that's anti-George Clooney, you change the character, you change the plot.
Mm-hmm.
I think Charade is like a very sort of comedic, kind of fun, kind of sexy thriller because we thought this kind of intrigue was quite, like, you know, sexy and mm-hmm. sophisticated and classy back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I kind of want, if we're going to do a remake, let's update that sentiment now with like what we kind of, like maybe expectations that we might have now versus reality of what this might actually be. We talked earlier about what if Mark Wahlberg's character like wasn't supposed to be doing this at all? What if he wasn't Mark Wahlberg? What if it was like, a lot of low-level government work now is just like getting the data, just like knee-deep in paperwork. So mm-hmm. what if it's just a basically like a nerd, some sort of desk nerd, who's doing all the like paperwork and trying to figure out, and this person is maybe like wishing for the days of yore where like this could be a little more exciting.
Right.
And thinks that he's gone to like the bottom of this thing and happens to find out that like the wife of this weird guy is like gone on vacation, and he's like, maybe I could like just do a thing real quick. And he takes his own vacation to like do some sort of weird, he has no idea what he's doing. He doesn't even really get field training because they're not supposed to do field training. But he goes and tries to like suss this out and sort of finds himself sort of stumbling into this plot ass first because he doesn't know that Charles is about to get murdered. And then he does. And then he's like, well, now I gotta like try to see this through.
Yeah.
And I've already got like kind of an in with the wife because I met her real quick and I couldn't really figure anything out at the time. And I like the idea that likewise, he might have expectations about what the wife of some guy who he knows is a mm-hmm. disgraced sort of soldier for hire who stole a bunch of money,
mm-hmm.
that he might have expectations of what she might be like. And like, it's the kind of woman who would marry this asshole.
Right.
Meanwhile, she has no idea who this man really is.
Right.
She doesn't like this man.
Right.
So, and then she also maybe has this, whatever expectations she has of this guy who she has no idea. He's just making up whatever random bullshit he can think of. Maybe he's okay at lying. He's okay enough to come up with a decent cover story or at least kind of like lie close to the truth and say, like, oh, I have, like, a boring government job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really get to leave my desk much, etc. I just leave out the details and things like that. So I kind of want to tell the same story, but have it kind of be this, like, he didn't think that this was going to be like this. She didn't think that this adventure was going to be like this. So I just, like,
no one told him life was going to be this way.
Yeah, no one told him life was going to be And yeah, like everyone, yeah, basically everyone having their expectations like wait, like what the fuck is really happening here? Because yeah. everyone's walking into it with their own assumptions of like what is happening, and nobody is right about any of it. So they're all operating under these incorrect realities that they think are happening. Like he's convinced at the beginning that she's in on this whole thing and she's not. The soldiers are convinced maybe of a different thing that she's not aware of it, but that he put the money on her person somewhere and they have to get it before she knows. Etc. I mean, well, she might find out super early on in the movie from the cops, but nobody else knows that because she doesn't tell anyone else correctly. I want it to kind of be a comedy where it's like everyone has all these different pieces of information. Everyone's operating under a different sort of like reality scope. And so like nobody, it just gets, it's like a like sort of chaotic comedy spy thing. That's it.
I like it.
Yeah, fun.
That does sound fun.
Okay, so for mine, so the obvious thing to say is, and I hate like using vague fixes like this, but like the obvious thing is that this should just have been a movie inspired by Charade and yeah. the French New Wave versus an actual remake of Charade filtered through the lens of the French New Wave, because that was simply like doomed to failure from the get-go. There was no way that could have possibly worked. For you to have made it work, you would have had to have like shorn so many details from Charade to the point that it's almost not Charade anymore. It doesn't matter. And also, like, the thing that perplexes me the most is, like, this was an idea that Demme had. This wasn't like the studio came to him and was like, we want to remake Charade. Like, will you remake Charade for us? And he was like, I guess I will.
Mm.
It's not like the studio was, like, forcing him to do Charade. He wanted to do Charade. I don't understand why you need to do Charade right. for this is my biggest sort of takeaway. So, like, it should probably just be an original story, first of all. That being said, if you wanted to do Charade done through the style of the French New Wave, you would have to, as I said, get rid of a whole bunch of crap. I think you need to get rid of the entire, Mark Wahlberg's entire business of having multiple secret identities would have to go out the window. You would probably, I think, axe Carson Dial, I think. It would probably just be, like, the three villains trying to, like, make sense of this with you. Mom's gotta go. Like, why the fuck is Mom in this movie? Mom, you gotta go.
Mom could lift out.
Yeah, no, I don't understand why that was added to this movie. It feels like it was just added there to give, like, that fun little scene at the end.
Exactly.
Where she kills Tim Robbins. But, like, why is that there? Why do we care? It doesn't matter. So, like, I don't get it. Anyway, as I said before, like, the biggest issue that I have with this movie, aside from the fact that you would obviously need to recast someone, or recast the Mark Wahlberg character with someone who is not Mark Wahlberg, having heard Denzel, I think that's kind of what I'm thinking right now, to be honest. Denzel, I think, makes it also vibes with, I think, Demi's original intention to have two black actors in the part. So Denzel, why not?
And wasn't he going to work with Denzel a few years later?
Yeah, in The Manchurian Candidate, in another remake. So, as I said previously, like, so much of the ending kind of falls flat for me in this movie. You have that Mexican standoff that doesn't really do anything. When you compare it to the original Charade, how you have, like, the chase through the subway, which ends them in the theater, with, the, like, both Cary Grant and Walter Matthau being like, don't trust him, trust me, and they're like, no, 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 I'm the one telling the truth, blah, blah, blah. You have all sort of fun stuff like that that is simply not in this movie that doesn't make it very enjoyable. So the entirety of Act 3 would need to have a refresh. The biggest thing that I was hoping that this movie would do that it doesn't do. So there's the brief scene that we talked about where Tandy Wayne Newton figures out, without telling the audience, that stamps are where the money has been hidden. And she calls the police officer, and the police officer's like, great, come on over, we'll work this out. And then later on, you see her, like, she seems to be confused when Mark Wahlberg's like, why is he going to the hotel, Tandy Wayne? And she's like, I don't fucking know. And so, like, you sort of expect, like, oh, I kind God. Of was thinking, like, wait, has she not figured it out, or is it something different or something like that? And you find out, like, no, she's playing dumb, and she has indeed figured out, and she has a decoy copy of stamps. So this is also a minor detail that I kept thinking about when I was watching the original movie, is that stamps lose their value if you adhese them to an envelope. So, like, you've already sort of lost a big chunk of your investment there at this point. So I was like going nuts. I wish to God that you could change stamps to be anything else in this remake, because I think that also adds another Bitcoin. Why is he locking up? Why is he checking Bitcoin stocks, Tandy Wayne? What is that? What's crypto?
Tandy Wayne, Dogecoin
is this
up.
Doge?
What's the NFT? Yeah.
What's NFT stand for, Tandy Wayne?
Why are those apes so poor?
So I was, like, literally going nuts trying to figure out what you would replace stamps with. And I was like, oh, he's ostensibly, like, an art dealer. Did he find, like, a journal with a sketch in it that was very valuable? But, like, I feel like if you throw that on the table and you're like, here's an old book with a sketch on it, someone would be like, should we get this looked at? Because, like, stamps are so fucking benign that it works perfectly.
That would be,
perfectly.
Like, a good joke, like, a good modern art joke, that there's, like, a
piece of artwork.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, and some guy looks like, this is bullshit. Like, some guy just doodled this.
That would be incredible.
And so, like, I was, like, thinking, like, is it, like, because he's an art dealer, like, is there a rare postcard? And then I wrote down LOL Pokemon cards. And so, like, I just love the idea of him, like, whipping out, like, a holographic Charizard and be like, what the fuck is this?
Look, it's a shiny!
Yeah. So the problem is, I don't know what you would replace the stamps with, and I wish to God I did, but there needs to be something different.
Can I have that for my nerd one?
So take it, please.
Could that be sort of
he's the one that understands what the thing is, because he's a nerd?
Yes,
he plays Pokemon.
It is the similar concept of, like, investment items, and some people will decide that's, like, an apartment or real estate, or sometimes that can be like a Birkin bag.
Right. I mean, I think the thing of it is, yes, for Charade, it has to, or Charlie, it has to be, like, a small, innocuous item that you don't immediately think has value, because it looks so benign and boring that you just don't associate the two. And the problem is, I truly don't know what that is. I wish to God this movie had found something different, because I think it would be a great way to sort of pull the rug out from the audience at the end and be like, you thought it was stamps, but actually, no, it's this now. So, like, don't start thinking that you are ahead of us with this sort of thing. I think this movie needed some sort of clever such and such like that. I wish I could have fixed it, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah, the cards could be in a cigarette case.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you mean it's on the blockchain? How do we get it off?
Should I get my wrench?
I'm going to...
Can you bowl cut us?
When I go home, this is how I'm going to talk to Paul.
Paul?
Hey, what you doing?
Paul?
What you doing,
What's
Paul?
What's happening, Paul?
What you watching?
What's going on?
Say hi to your mother for me.
So yeah, that's like my half-assed fix. My half-assed fix is like, for one, this movie just shouldn't have existed. Mm-hmm. And it just should be something inspired. But like, if you had to, you know, zhuzh up what you had here, it's a couple of things like that, honestly, yeah, that I think would have made this more watchable. So having covered all of that, what do you think? Would you guys recommend it?
No.
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 I kind of like this movie.
You do? I was not expecting this.
Kind of like is what I would place it at.
It's just like things in it that are fun.
Yeah, and I told you guys when I was watching this, I was like, oh boy, like, do I actually like the truth about Charlie? And no, I don't. Is it a good movie? No. Does it work? No. But there is something about this that's like, it's almost like Gus Van Sant remaking Psycho.
Right.
To the point where I'm kind of like, well, if you can get a studio to give you $20 million to remake Charade and filter it through the French New Wave lens, maybe you should. Well, like, maybe you should just do it.
There is also like, it's not like it's utter garbage. Like, there is a certain level of quality that I think in a similar way, to him that Jonathan Demme does here. Like, it's not like an actively torturous movie.
No, because like I said, Jonathan Demme's not an idiot. He knows how to make a movie.
Right.
While I can't outright recommend this movie to people, I'm weirdly kind of fascinated by it in a way that I didn't think I would be. So, like, I am glad we did this just because I think it's such a strange experience to sort of, like, watch.
I kind of get where you're coming from with your recommendation. Mm-hmm. I can't in good conscience recommend this to people.
Nor should you.
But I'm not going to say that I didn't get anything out of it. I got some stuff out of watching this movie. I just don't think that it's worth your time.
Yeah. I mean, again, like I said, it's not good.
Yeah.
And it like, in execution, it does not work. And it could probably have never worked very well. But, like, I appreciate when someone takes big swings like this, you know, at the end of the day. Like, I'd rather you create a very interesting sort of failure. Anyway, facebook.com/whywatchpodcast is our Facebook page. Dropback.com is our website. Podcast, of course, as always, can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Premium, that sort of things. So you can follow, rate, subscribe, whatever the fuck they're calling it now.
Figure out getting us on Spotify.
Cash us outside.
Come back at us in two weeks.
Mini episode. And a bonne nuit to you all, I suppose. At this
bonne nuit!
Adieu!
Adieu!